of the crop.
Welcome to the 170th edition of the Gooner Podcast. This is your host, Kevin Witcher, and we are recording this on the Tuesday evening after Arsenal's win at Blackpool in the third round of the FA Cup, a few days before they make the somewhat shorter journey to West Ham in the Premier League. As traditional, before we get going, I will introduce the panel. First up, one of our most regular contributors, a man of legal standing. He applied for the legal job at Arsenal once, and the club seemed very keen, until they did their due diligence and discovered he was involved with the Gooner.
That's all very true, sadly.
And that was that. Instead, he had to suffer the pains of issuing legal advice on The Only Way is Essex and Geordie Shore. It would have probably been just the same at Arsenal if you substituted Nicholas Bentner for Gemma Collins. It's a warm welcome to Mr. David Udo.
Hello there.
Next, the founder and original editor of The Gooner. His day job keeps him so busy these days, we only get the occasional well-played contribution. But fortunately, he remains active by appearing on the podcast when his diary allows. Based in deepest Kent, once the no-deal Brexit hits, he won't be able to drive to the local supermarket without joining a queue of juggernauts. It's a very good evening to Mr. Mike Francis.
If only you were joking.
And last but not least, Fleet Street's most hard-working journalist, as those who follow his Twitter or Instagram accounts can testify. And what do you know? He's become an Instagram buddy of one Tony Adams, who often responds to his posts there. It's very gratifying that he still finds time to help us out on the Gooner, and with so much on his plate, he has to be the man with the most tolerant wife in the country. It's good to say hello once more to Mr. Laith Yusuf.
Cheers, Kev. Thanks for the intro.
And now, gentlemen, since the last podcast, Arsenal have played five Premier League games. Two home wins were chalked up against Burnley and Fulham, whilst trips to Southampton, Brighton and Liverpool have proved less rewarding, with 1 point out of nine. Are the wheels coming off?
Oof.
That's a big question.
Yeah. No, I don't think so. I mean, I think, you know, we've had some... Liverpool was a tricky game. It's always going to be. Now, I mean, who was confident going into that? No one. So I think the injuries haven't helped. But to say the wheels have come off, I think it's probably overdramatic. I think we were probably being a bit fortunate that we hadn't had a defeat or two before that. There had been plenty of games where we probably hadn't deserved the result we got. So, you know, the signs were maybe there that there was a bad one coming around the corner. I didn't necessarily expect it to be at Southampton, and disappointed then not to win at Brighton as well. But the Liverpool one was just like almost inevitable. Well, like, not mean they're in a different class to us at the moment, aren't they? But I mean, giving him his due. I mean, Klopp, that's his fourth season at Liverpool now, and he's had four transitional seasons building the team that he wants, and we're in like the first of our transitional seasons. I mean, I hate to say this, but I agreed with Gary Neville's assessment of our team after the Liverpool defeat, in the sense that he's deliberately leaving people at Özil out, in the sense that, you know, this is the way that my team is playing. We are building from goalkeeper upwards. I want you to press. If you don't fit in, then, you know, you're not going to play in certain conditions, which is why Özil's make-believe Christmas time injuries are coming into play again. But, you know, it's a transitional season. He's viewing how they get on, and then over the course of this current transfer window, summer, and then probably the January and summer after those, he's going to formulate the team he wants. So, I mean, I wasn't expecting anything going into the season. The 21-22 unbeaten run, where it wasn't unbeaten games against Barcelona, Real Madrid, Manchester Rovers, etc., was it? You know, so I'm not worried about it. We're still rebuilding.
Yeah. I mean, I think the 22 match unbeaten run raised expectations higher than people were expecting at the start of the season, certainly after the two defeats against Man City and Chelsea. But the wheels come off. No, Liverpool, we knew we were going to, you know, we knew Arsenal were not going to win at Anfield unless they put on a really, really special performance, which just wasn't going to happen because at the time Liverpool were flying. That came on the back of I was down in Brighton. I was in the way with my kids, had a day off at busman's holiday, and took all three down, and I was quite pleased in a way because the second half was so bad it just made my kids realise that, you know, that's what football is. It's not about winning trophies and all the rest of it.
It's about pain.
It's about pain, yeah, exactly. So, But yeah, if you're looking at it objectively, then yeah, it wasn't a particularly good performance. Aubameyang could have made it 2-0 in the first half, and I think that would have won the game for us. But yeah, point at Brighton, probably not to be sniffed at. Chris Hughton's done a really good job down there, and I don't think that's anything to worry about. On the back, prior to that, was a 3-1 victory against Burnley, and that was 3 points in the bag. It's one of those sort of instantly forgettable games. Apart from the fact, I was in the press room afterwards, and Sean Dyche had an absolute meltdown with Arsenal, basically accusing Arsenal of corrupting millions and millions of young children about diving and things like that. And it was a thing of beauty to behold, basically. And I wrote about it afterwards, and a lot of people read it. But that was another 3 points for Arsenal. Obviously, if you're going back to Southampton, that wasn't a particularly good game, and that was the end of the unbeaten run. But we beat Fulham. Arsenal beat Fulham 4-1 on New Year's Day, although admittedly it was the most unconvincing 4-1 you'd ever see. I couldn't believe how bad Fulham were, and Arsenal weren't particularly much better, to be fair. Defensively, Fulham were absolutely dreadful, so I'm not sure how much that told us about Arsenal or Fulham, apart from the fact Fulham couldn't defend. And then obviously Blackpool, we had a bit of a chat a minute ago, and I felt that Arsenal were always in control. I'm a Nandule, missed a couple of chances. I sort of covered him when he was at Stevenage, and he didn't pull up many trees there, so I wasn't particularly worried watching the game in Bloomfield Road in terms of a defeat. Willock played well, obviously, and if you contrast this to this time last year, the dreadful 4-2 defeat at Forest, he played in that game, and he's improved so much. And I think I made a point of tweeting this out at the time. I think I've obviously covered him for the under-18s, under-21s, under-23s. He's benefited so much from playing in the Checker Trophy this year. He's learnt so much, just like Saka has, just like a few others have as well, playing against seasoned lower league pros. And you could see that against Blackpool. Blackpool did well get promoted from League 2 last season, admittedly with the boycott and all the unrest that's going on at Blackpool. They must have been the only set of fans who didn't actually want to get promoted, but they did, and they're doing quite well in League 1 under Terry McPhillips. And you just felt that, it could have been an upset, but it wasn't, for lots of reasons, not least the fact there was a boycott there and the atmosphere was flat, and they didn't play as well as they did in the League Cup game when Arsenal won 2-1 in October. So that was the sort of, that was on the Blackpool side. But at the same time, Arsenal still had to play well, and Willock played well. I thought Maitland-Niles played well. He did a really good drag back for the third goal to start the goal. I love quick feet, I love technique, but it was efficient as well, and it started the move. He played Ramsey out wide, who slotted into the middle when it was 3-0, basically through Iwobi. Iwobi, I'm pretty sure, did he play in the Forest game as well last season? There was all party going on at the time, wasn't there? So I can't remember if he did or not, but the improvement in some of those players under Emery, to go back to your original point, was tangible, basically. And I don't think the wheels coming off at all. Like the guy said, Emery needs probably 2 or 3 transfer windows. Klopp's had, God knows, 7 or 8, basically, to mould the squad and the team the way he wants it. And Emery needs time, and he's got time, to be fair, from most Arsenal fans. If you're booing him, then you're an idiot, basically, as far as I'm concerned.
I don't think it's got to that stage.
No, absolutely not.
The Highbury librarian on Twitter, he quoted me from 2012 saying,
"That was a good tweet."
why I was not afraid of a change of manager. But his question above it was, "Has Unai Emery got more from our players? Do the players appear to be more motivated and better organised?" Well, better organised is an interesting one.
They're following instructions, and I get the impression you didn't really have that under Arsene Wenger, whose instructions were, be yourselves. Express yourself, it's one-on-one, to quote Messrs. Sumner and Hook. Whereas Emery is like, one of the things I like about him is he's outside of the managerial box, he's right on the touchline, shouting instructions, which is technically a breach of the laws, isn't it? Coaching from the touchline, but notwithstanding that.
Not anymore.
Is that right?
It used to be, not anymore.
I happily stand corrected. But he's ordering his team about, I want you to play this certain way. As I mentioned earlier, he's saying, this is the way my team is playing, I'm going to flex it the way that I want to, maybe start 3 at the back, go 5 at the back. I remember for 10 minutes against Fulham, we actually played in a 4-4-2, which really turned me on, to be completely honest. It took me back to the days when I had hair.
It was a long time ago.
Seriously, it was actually in colour. It was It's my way or the highway, I think, and he's getting more out of people. I mean, Iwobi was written off by a lot of people at the start of the season. Yeah. Hello to my father, who never listens, but even so, in the sense that Dowie's rubbish. But we're seeing an awful lot more out of Iwobi because he's getting formal instructions. And whilst there's talent in him, when he's being told at the age of 18, just do your thing, I'll let you do your thing, he doesn't know what his thing is because he's 18 years old, incredibly inexperienced. Whereas I think he's been quite effective, Emery. He's given instructions and players are following it. If they're not, or they can't do that because they're inept and stuffy, then there will be some changes.
Yeah, I mean, I think going forward, we're certainly getting more out of the players going forward. I think we're just more efficient and effective going forward than we were last season under Wenger. Now, you know, I'm not saying how much of that is down to Emery or how much of that is just down to it's somebody different. I think there could be a lot said for it just being somebody different. I think people have got tired of hearing Wenger's voice. So, but at the back, you know, there's still a lot of the same faults, and not surprisingly, because it's a lot of the same players, Mustafi. And you know, he's not the only one. I just feel we've been unfortunate with injuries there. You know, Monreal is so consistent, and he's played what, 4 or 5 games this season, and even Bellerin recently. You know, I think Bellerin had actually was looking more like the player he was 3 or 4 years ago, and the player where we were expecting him to be, and perhaps worryingly the player Barcelona were expecting him to be. and so I think the injury sort of came at the wrong time for him. But there's still a lot there that's you kind of just go, we've been doing that for too long, giving the ball away simply. You know, Xhaka making stupid challenges, stupid dives. You know, so there's a lot that I think there's still to do, but. You know, I'm with David. I love seeing him up and down that technical box and 10 yards either side of it as well. Getting on their back, pointing and shouting at them. That is the modern manager these days. You know, you see all the modern managers doing that. And I do think that's where, you know, we under Wenger, it was depressing at times just to see him standing there.
Yeah.
Bemoaning the fourth official, which, you know, justifiably often, but, you know, but not really doing anything with the team.
Yeah, I completely agree with you both. In terms of the defence at the moment, it'd be interesting to see how many of those players are still there in 18 months' time.
If we can find people to buy them, I mean.
If we can find people to buy them, yeah. 35 million from the stuff, you're not sure about it. It's only 40 million less than Van Dijk, to be fair. You're absolutely right, both of you, in terms of. You know, there are a lot of encouraging signs going forward, but defensively there's still a lot of work to be done by a lot of players.
Is it personnel, or is there an element whereby the tactics leave them open?
I think for me, Emery's tactics require a certain type of player, and I don't think half those players are there at the moment. If you're talking about building from the back, pressing, you know, pressing down the flanks, building from the top in terms of pressing...
I think they can do that.
Do you think Mustafi can do that? Do you think?
Well, no, he's not the worst passer in the world.
No, but I think
my concern is when the other team have the ball.
Yeah, and someone like an Ozil is not going to track back. Mkhitaryan's not going to track back. And I know you can argue you've got to give a bit of leeway to creative players, but there's a certain type of player that you can see Emery wants, and you know, obviously with Ozil's £350,000 contract a week, and you wonder what's going to happen long term. But I think if Emery could get him out, he would, basically. Oh, same with Ramsey. I mean, I've seen a lot of you know, press conferences of Emery this season, and there's certain codes, and so you can read between the lines, basically. I just don't think he trusts him as much.
Doesn't trust Aaron Ramsey.
Yeah, long term to play as a player in a really pressing team. For me, Aaron Ramsey should be offered a new contract. I think he should be part of the club, but
the irony of that is Ramsey is someone who will chase down the ball.
Yeah, but is he dynamic enough to do that long term? I don't know. He falls between two stools. I don't think you could argue he's a box-to-box midfielder, but is he a box-to-box midfielder in a team that really presses? Would Jurgen Klopp pick him every week? I don't know if he would.
It depends on the role he's playing. I mean, he played deep line on Saturday, wasn't he? Yeah, he was. And he ran the gap.
Yeah.
You know, and
admittedly against League One.
Admittedly against League One, yeah, so we won't get too carried away. But although there were plenty that didn't the gap. I think I said on the podcast when I was on earlier in the season, when it was first announced that Ramsey's contract offer had been withdrawn, I think it got to the point where it was like, you can't play Ramsey and Ozil on the same team. And Ozil's on a £350,000 contract. We're going to have to offer Ramsey, whatever it was, £200,000 a week. And that 200 grand a week actually could be better deployed elsewhere if we're only going to be able to play one of them at a time.
Yeah.
And I still stand by that, you know, although based on performances since then, you'd rather have Ramsey than Ozil.
Yeah.
We haven't got that choice. It's kind of, we've got to have one or the other. We're stuck with Ozil. Unless we, if we could get rid of Ozil, I think Ramsey would then get a contract.
Yeah.
Or get offered one. Whether he'd accept it now, given that he's obviously been tapped up from elsewhere.
Yeah. I mean, I've done a couple of stories on that over the last week, and I've obviously done it long term as well. My understanding is that he was offered a contract of 225 grand a week that was subsequently withdrawn when Gazidis left, basically. So now he and Venkat were taken through the media centre.
So hang on a minute. Ramsey's agents thought 225 a week wasn't enough.
No, it wasn't that. They were obviously sitting there going, yeah, maybe we can get another 10, 15, 20 grand out of them. But they would have signed, definitely. And when that, the only reason it was withdrawn was because Gazidis was on a 3-month guarding leave to head off to AC Milan. As soon as he was sort of no longer sort of the power behind the throne, admittedly he was still at Arsenal, but he wasn't sort of pulling the strings, that offer was withdrawn. And Ramsey's agents actually tweeted a couple of tweets around early October, basically, you know, showing how shocked they were about that. And
well, maybe they should have signed it.
Yeah, maybe they should.
I would have thought 120.
Well, that's it. That's what I was going to say. The story came out of Italy, Mediaset, you know, Italy's main sort of media company. They were talking about a €34 million, 5-year deal, contract deal, basically, including sign-on fees, bonuses, and all the rest of it, which worked out about €30 million, which I did the maths, which is about 125 grand a week. You know, that's...
Well, that's including the signing on
fee. That's including everything, yeah. So it's like, that's 100 grand less than Arsenal were paying. The contract on the top, as far as I know, was 225 grand a week. That's 100 grand less than Arsenal were offering.
The thing is, you've got your other commercial terms in there. It's like Mourinho's big haggling when he last renewed a contract at Manchester United before he went was... I mean, the salary was agreed to start with, all the bonuses were. It was the argument over his over the commercial share of receipts on his visual images. So Mourinho's face and everything, what the split was going to be, but it was going to be 75-25, 60-40, knowing him, probably 85-15, I would have thought. So I wouldn't be surprised if that's the same for Ramsey, because every time you see like a tweet with like, I've seen this week, Xhaka is now the face of a new set of Puma boots, obviously they'll be Adidas next season.
Yeah.
But because that's associated with Arsenal, they're probably taking a 15% cut of that. Maybe I'm guessing, with my commercial lawyer hat on, I'm thinking that the salary was agreed an age ago, and it's the tiny nitty-gritty commercial terms, you know, in terms of who's going to pick him up from airports and stuff like that. Will it be an Addison Lee car? Will it be a private driver? Seriously, stuff like that.
Yeah,
bit by bit.
That's what took them so long to sign it, and by the time they realised that it was withdrawn, yeah.
Totally.
Yeah.
Wow, okay. So, we have the January transfer window. Well, it's already around us. It's already happening. And we've had a few questions related to that. I'll start with a couple. One from Jonathan Houseman. Does a lack of owner investment mean we're likely to fade when it comes to the financially crucial top four with injuries biting? And Pete Mountford, how skint are we? If so, how alarmed should we be? My question related to those two, without going into the Kroenke debate, because it's pretty well known he's not going to put money in. The club have effectively, in their sort of statements or interviews with the relevant people, pleaded poverty. Now, that might be them playing it cute and make out that they don't have much to spend, so that when they do get in negotiations, they are less likely to be quoted stupid figures if the selling club actually want to sell. What do you think is the real situation?
I can go, I mean, I worked in the City in a previous life, got an MBA and stuff, and I try and crunch some numbers now and then, but I defer every time to Swiss Ramble. He's a finance expert based in Switzerland, a big Arsenal fan, obviously. And he went through the accounts, what was released the other day, with a fine tooth comb, basically. And I think the last sort of stuff that I saw, Arsenal had earned 198 million under Gazidis, basically, in terms of revenue, which is half decent. But it was still only the fourth or fifth highest out of the big six, basically. We were only ahead of Spurs, basically.
Was that clean profit, EBITDA, or was that just turnover?
God, I think it was EBIT, yeah, okay. Because, get me NBA head on there. Late nights, I'd study that.
Just carry the one.
Yeah. Yeah, so you could argue that Gazidis didn't do his job in terms of increasing revenue streams, but is that Arsenal's level? You know, I'm not sure they're capitalising enough on where they are in terms of a global city, being in London, you know, having all the corporate sort of, you know, streams that could be enhanced as well. So, you know, did Gazidis do as well as he could? Swift Ramble didn't think so, basically.
So who's ahead of us? I mean, it's okay, you've got Man United,
£303 million.
We know Man City and Chelsea make up the figures as they go along. Man United, fair enough.
Yeah, but Chelsea were above Arsenal as well. That's the worrying thing.
Well,
really.
Chelsea, fair, yeah. Well,
in terms of revenue,
I think Abramovich still piles money in on the
yeah, but that was money coming
stuff.
In. It wasn't. Yeah, maybe. Yeah,
you
maybe.
Know, so,
but in terms of money earned from the club. Or by the club.
But you said fifth or sixth, so you said we were only above Spurs, so Liverpool were above us as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, which is
well, you've
got
to remember, Liverpool had Champions League.
Yeah.
They had a long old run.
And there was another point I was going to say as well. Obviously, Gazidis said about 5 years ago that Arsenal were ready to compete with Bayern Munich. And Swiss Ramp made a really, really good point. He basically said Arsenal were about 120 million behind in terms of revenue compared to Bayern Munich. Got down to about 80 million, which, you know, you could argue a 50 million sort of deficit is half decent. But they're going to lose 40, 50 million this year because of the lack of Champions League. So it's gone back to where we are. So basically, in those terms, Arsenal have been treading water financially versus Bayern Munich, which was a sort of benchmark that Gazidis set Arsenal up for. So what have they done in the last 5 or 6 years, basically? And it's slightly worrying. There is money there. And also, they were talking about cash reserves. Arsenal, I think, had cash reserves around 128 million 3 or 4 seasons ago, which was equal or more than every other Premier League club put together. Mm. Now, you know, it's been cut. I think Arsenal still have a substantial amount of cash reserves. But
legally, they need to keep a certain amount in the bank.
Yeah, but you're talking, you look at some Premier League clubs, they've got 2 or 3 million in the bank. You know, obviously, you've got creative accounting as well. Arsenal had 128 million. I don't know what it is.
No, there was definitely a.
Oh, for Arsenal, you're talking specifically rather than sort of Premier League
roles.
I'm talking
about Arsenal specifically. Yeah. Because of the stadium. Debt arrangements.
Yeah, but
they are obliged to keep a certain amount. However, I 100% agree, what they did was keep their powder dry.
Yeah.
And while they were keeping their powder dry, the cost of a transfer for an established top-class player went through the roof.
Absolutely.
So that money, what it could have bought you 4 years ago, it's not worth so much now.
Yeah.
And anyway, they're posting losses. They're posting... The only way they're not going to post... trading losses is if they sell players now because of the wage bill.
Yeah, absolutely.
So they've got themselves in a pickle. And this is presumably the reason why the likes of Sven Mislintat have been, you know, recruited. Because he could save the club. Well, he could get players in that can help the club without the club suffering too much.
Yeah, and it's also a case of buying players and potentially selling them on.
Yeah, that is going to be the model.
Yeah, you buy
that
Torreira,
is going to be
million,
the model.
For 80 million in 2 years.
Absolutely right.
Yeah. Torreira has a great rest of the season as he started. I mean, notwithstanding the last 3-4 weeks when the guy's knackered, bless him.
Yeah.
You know, but if he picks it up and he becomes the new Kante, I suppose, and we get offered £100 million, surprised he's gone.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. 100%.
And that's when Guendouzi becomes the new Torreira. And then he'll go to Paris Saint-Germain for £100 million, repeat ad infinitum. Yeah.
So to get back to the question, how alarmed should we be? Or in other words, can we be optimistic that money doesn't inevitably equal success, and this can be done?
Well, it does. It doesn't. I mean, like, you know, Leicester proved that, didn't they? I mean, and everyone's going to keep pointing back to Leicester probably for the rest of all our lives. but it's true. You know, you can only play 11 players on the pitch at any one time. You know, unless you've got a bent referee. But having a squad, yeah, that's great. But you know, you look at Man City. Man City had De Bruyne and Aguero not playing a lot this season, and probably others. You know, so you can only play so many players, and if you get lucky with injuries, as Leicester probably did, you know, money isn't the be-all and end-all. And I think it is tactical. You know, we've put in some decent performances this season against teams that were probably better than us. And so, you know, you've got to trust in the coach to deliver, to get more out of the players than and get more than the sum of the parts. Isn't it?
Yes. Coach is very much the opposite of expression. I mean, one of the famous last few things that Wenger did was when he was asked about Raul Sonier coming in as like a director of football operations, whatever title he had. And Wenger just went, it didn't go spare, but he said, I don't see the point of this director of football thing whatsoever. Well, because Wenger was the manager as far as he's concerned, having final say over absolutely everything, whereas now Emery is what he is, he's head coach. And he put desires onto Mislintat, Sanyehi and our other joint MD, saying, this is what I want. You go and do that, because that's your three people's job, because I have to coach these people. But it's becoming more like the NFL now, where your general manager is worth as much as the head coach, as it were. So, I mean, Emery's doing a great job, so I always have to be on the likes of Mislintat and go.
Well, that was it. I mean, there was a comment you made earlier, which I was going to come back on, was, you know, we talked about Klopp having had all these transfer markets, and Emery's got to have all these transfer markets. But actually, it's not Emery having all these transfer markets.
No.
It's the guys that job it is to go and buy the players. You know, and it's like, how many of the players that we actually got in the summer were Emery purchases? You know, there was certainly when Torreira was left out earlier on in the season. You know, and Guendouzi was playing every game. You know, there were a few question marks raised, going, well, maybe Torreira wasn't his signing, and Guendouzi was, and that's why he's playing. Like, he's justified that by saying it was to acclimatise him and getting used to it, and it's probably proved right in the long run. But you do wonder how much of it is going to be Emery's choice of player and how much of it is going to be elsewhere. Now, Gazidis always used to say there's no point having a manager if you're not going to trust him to have the final say. You don't want to give him players he doesn't want. But
although there was
a suggestion in the last year that Wenger did get players that he hadn't asked for.
Gabriel, I remember when
Gabriel,
when,
not so much, to be honest. I was like, that was a, I was thinking more in the last year.
Oh, no, I was thinking, I mean, Gabriel, there are rumours that was a stats signing, a money ball thing. And I won't forget when we signed Danny Welbeck on transfer deadline day that year, and the first press conference was, you must be pleased with that. He said, well, I only wanted him on loan. Well, who did the purchase option, though? Yeah. That would have been our chairman, I would have thought. But, I mean, all I know is that Mislintat's background is from Borussia Dortmund, and we've bought an awful lot of Borussia Dortmund-linked players in the last calendar year since he joined, you know. So, I mean, personally, I think the Lichtsteiner and Socrates were bought in by him in the sense that that's like ripping out old things, putting new things, in the sense that these guys, they're hard bastards, and they're going to play like, not stylish footballing defenders, they're going to play like defenders. Sunday league defenders.
Yeah. And I really like Socrates.
Agreed.
And I think one of the things as well is that we haven't really had the opportunity is to get a defence playing as a unit for 10 games on the trot. Yeah.
Oof.
You know, it'd be nice, wouldn't it? And given the changes that Emery's trying to make in the pressing game and how they want to play, I think that would really help. And if we could get that, doesn't have to be the same back four, but roughly the same, not significant changes week in, week out, we might see more solidity there. Might be in the operative word. But
you discuss the people and their roles in the club. Pradeep Kachala on Facebook says, with the potential appointment of Edu, and this is in a director of football role, apparently, is there a danger we are becoming over-governed? Is there any clarity between all the recent appointments and what they exactly do? So basically, we've got a head of football relations who became head of football, I understand. Mm-hmm. Not a director of football, obviously, because they're trying to recruit one.
Head of
Brazil.
Football operations, isn't it?
That was what he started. Oh, but then he became, once Ivan Gazidis departed, he became head of football. That was his official job title, I believe. So now we've got a director of football. What's Edu going to do that Sané can't do?
I think he's probably got more contacts in the game.
Right, so he's been brought in to get more Brazilians.
Sané would have had lots of contacts from his time at Barcelona.
Yeah, potentially, but obviously,
maybe the South American market, you might be right.
Well, bear in mind the brilliant job that Danny Carbassayoun did in North American recruits we've got, then come on, good luck, Edu.
Don't knock Danny.
He's a nice bloke.
Don't knock Danny, tweeted me at the weekend.
Sorry, Danny.
Yeah, he did actually.
I'm not dissing you.
We're friends on Facebook as well.
No, I think in short, I mean, football is changing an awful lot. I mean, I remember when I was 7 years old, started working in 80, watching in 88, 89, our entire football...
You mean 78, 79?
Oh, bless you. Bless you. I wasn't even a wink in my dad's, whatever. So, the entire football side was George Graham, Theo Foley, Stuart Houston, George Armstrong, and a physiotherapist. That was it. I mean, Bob Wilson was a part-time goalkeeping coach. That was it. Player negotiations, Watford Gap Services on the M1, signed this fucking contract. Whereas now, if you go to the staff section on Arsenal.com and the amount of staff who got related with the first team, I mean, we've got more physios than we had goalkeepers in 1989. True story. I mean, it's a completely different game now. And you've got negotiations to happen, you know, people to negotiate negotiations and, you know, act for and on behalf of other people, whatever. I'd like to know exactly what everyone's role is and see their job descriptions, because that's something you don't get on Arsenal.com.
Yeah, I remember being at a presser towards the end of last season when Wenger was on his way out, and he was in quite a reflective mood, and he was sort of just saying that, you know, he looked really bemused the fact there was 800 employees at Arsenal, and he made a point of referring to the fact they had an HR department as if like that was like really weird or something. But like the club, you're absolutely right, you know, it's changed completely. I remember, like I say, going up as a kid getting tickets from the travel club, and Johnson was there, and you know, the junior gunners, and they had that little sort of room, and now it's like, you know, it's just completely exploded basically. And it's a different club, and so it should be, because times have to move on. You can't have Jack Kelsey in the club shop as much as you want to. He's obviously an Arsenal legend, but I remember him being really grumpy. Like, I remember my mate, everyone's grumpy to me, but I remember, like, we qualified for like finals and stuff, and you had the little vouchers in the back of the programme. My mate tried to get a couple to fill it in because you had to cut them out and stick them on the thing. Jack Kelsey took great pleasure in putting an X through right in front of my mate. I'll never forget. And he never smiled, but he was almost smiling to say, "Look, son, you're not going to work for
that." God rest his soul. So cruel.
That's my memories of Jack Kelsey.
Is he not on the 32 around the stadium?
I hope so. He deserves to be.
I think that little anecdote should be added to his bio at the bottom, frankly. I've never heard that. Oh, what a shocker.
God bless you.
Well, we can't speak into the dead,
no,
but.
Absolutely.
Anyway. All right, so let us look elsewhere. And let's just take a diversion, a bit of light-hearted stuff. Have we seen the leaked images of the Adidas kits for next season?
I thought of something like that. It's like, is it a 14-year-old in his bedroom just going, "Look, there's an Arsenal kit from Adidas exclusive"? And you're like,
It could be.
It could be, yeah, absolutely. And maybe Adidas are playing it smart and leaking it through their contacts, I don't know. But until I actually see it from, you know, and the actual launch, I'm not going to believe a word of it, basically. But it should be red and white. It's not rocket science. You know, white arms, red trim, traditional red top. The second kit should be yellow and blue. Do what you want with the third kit. Make it a tube of refreshers. I don't care. Those are the kits. And Adidas, I love Adidas. I've got a pair of Adidas Gazelles on. You know, obviously, anyone from Adidas is listening. You know, feel free to send me something. I'm more than happy to support it. But Adidas are brilliant, and they won't muck it up the way the current kit sponsors and kit makers, I should say, are doing it. And I've got three kids all in junior gunners. I'd ban them from buying anything from Arsenal in terms of that kit, because it's an absolute travesty. It's not an Arsenal kit, as far as I'm concerned. I like sort of thinking, I'm a bit reactionary and a bit aggressive and that, but in terms of the Arsenal kit, I am completely traditional, and it should be red and white and yellow and blue. Simple as that. Do what you want with the third kit. And I'm not going to even mention their name, but what they've done with all three kits is absolutely disgusting. And the sooner Adidas get in there, the better. As far
so what, what? What's the objection to the home kit?
It's awful, isn't it? Where are the white sleeves? They're not properly white. Why does it look like they're wearing an apron? It's, you know, it's just awful. Absolutely dreadful.
We had that. It sickens me. We had under Adidas. Very similar. I think it was 91, actually.
No, that was a nice kit. That was a nice collar.
Don't be slating a 91 kit.
The apron thing, as in the white going here. That's what I'm talking
that's
about.
That's FA Cup 93.
Is it 93?
Yeah, when we had like the red and blue zigzag thing.
The white coming up the shoulders was even in...
God, was that 91 or 93?
I think it was 1991. I remember seeing a picture of a new signings, like Linegan wearing it in 90.
God, yeah. See, wasn't it in 89? Didn't the
no, no,
they
in 89 it's
to the collar.
Do you think?
But it was properly white and it was red.
Yeah, no, it's where the red starts and the white. Yeah, I mean, it should be there.
It's got to be
on the shoulder joint.
My real pet hate.
Anyway, so. mixed views from it does look possible though, because you could imagine they would incorporate an element of the tractor design. In the away kit they have got that you know, those, that shape, if nothing else, even if it's, if it's all yellow.
Doesn't strike me as the three stripes are long enough on the arm. If they went all the way up to the top of the shoulder where it joins the neck, maybe, but they're only a little portion.
It's tunic.
Just a quick diversion here on Adidas. So I've got a signed shirt from 88-89. Or no, it's a replica 88-89 shirt that's signed, and I actually got around to framing it just before Christmas. And I hadn't even realised that it's only got two stripes down the arm.
Oh,
Because it's replica, it's not Adidas.
Because they can't do the copyright.
I'd never even spotted it before, and I was just trying to...
Is there a cockerel on the badge as well?
I'll do it like, you know, fold it on the third stripe, on the middle stripe, and I was like, where's the middle?
Right, let's talk about a couple of individuals. Central defenders, obviously a shortage at the moment. Now, in theory, we could get Callum Chambers back from Fulham if we paid presumably half of his loan fee back.
Great business.
So if Fulham have paid us £4 million, we've got to pay
Fulham for Ryan Taylor, basically.
£2 million to get him back.
Shocking. Is that how much loan fees are now?
Well, apparently that is what I've read.
Apparently we've got a loan consultant, but ironically he's not actually starting until February.
That's
maybe the reason he's, given that job.
Yeah. He's our finance manager for Wonga.
So my question about Callum Chambers... If the club won't pay £2 million for him to get 5 months out of him, does that say something about the club or Unai Emery's belief in Callum Chambers?
He liked Chambers in pre-season. He featured him in a fair few of the friendlies, and he looked all right, then literally went to Fulham overnight. I get the impression that's more of a Sam Leahy decision, in the sense that you've got too many defenders on paper with this Mavropanos. You've got basically, you've got these three young centre-halves, choose two. One's got to go. Or if you can't take it, I've got some interest in Chambers, he's going. Head coach. You have to coach these two. It was a very, very sudden decision.
So you don't think anything to do with Emery, and the reason they won't get him back is because San Leigh doesn't fancy him?
Well,
they just broke.
The latter. I was going to say, I still can't remember the full name of our other managing director, but ultimately that's repaying money we've been given for a player we don't really need.
But then it means we haven't got £2 million to spend in the transfer market in January.
No, we don't want to spend that particular, the £2 million with regards to that, in the sense that letting him go is probably with a view to him going permanently.
Right.
Looking at some of the names I've seen in the press, one is Benatia at Juventus, who's had a falling out there, a world-renowned, very good centre-half, and on paper that makes sense if we could just rush through the Ramsey thing now, because rather than going for free, we do a Sanchez-McAtari in part two and just do a straightforward swap deal now. Again, from an earning and turnover point of view, makes a lot of sense from my bottom line. I'm sure that Uncle Stan will like it the same.
Okay. All right. I mean, do we expect to see Callum Chambers in an Arsenal shirt again?
Not if you have to pay £2 million for your own player.
No, but even next season.
Next season. How many master players have been on loan for a season, come back and done well? Jack Wilshere at Bolton.
Ashley Cole
at Palace.
Thanks to Silvino's passport.
How long was
Alex Song at Charlton?
Oh, that's a good point. Yeah. But I mean, we're talking what, 2, 3, 4 players in 20 years.
Yeah.
I don't think he's got a future at Arsenal long term.
Bentner was on loan quite a bit, wasn't he?
I'm trying to think where he went.
He was at Birmingham.
Did he go on loan to like the
it was Birmingham.
Wasn't he King of Denmark for a while or something? Came back again, but
okay. So Ozil. Now, do we? You don't believe the back injury is genuine? Okay. Although he did have it before the latest bout. He came back and then he got it again.
Yeah.
So if it was true in the first place, it's possible that it just resurfaced.
Skeptical me doesn't know if it was true in the first place.
Okay.
You know.
But, you know, he could have played at Blackpool if that was... I mean, is he feigning injury? Or are the club pretending he's injured?
Because if the club come out and publicly say, no, we're not playing him because he's got an attitude issue, he doesn't fit into our team.
His value.
That takes £5 million off him, you know. And
yeah.
I mean, the amount of times I've sat in press conferences after the game and Emery's been asked about it, and he just finds it absolutely tedious. I just don't think he trusts him. He doesn't particularly rate him as a player who can work hard.
But you've got this guy you're paying 350 grand a week to.
Yeah.
You must get something out of
him. Yeah, and I think Emery's tried. And I think, to be fair, Ozil's tried to a certain extent, but he'll never track back. It's not in his nature to track back.
Yeah.
But if you had a solid enough defence, could you excuse that?
I think you could. I think you can... You can have one player who won't necessarily fit into your tactics and in your sort of overall ethos and principles if you've got 10 other functioning players in that particular scheme. But it's not happening at the moment because the back four, or the back three, back five, whatever you want to call it, it just isn't good enough and aren't playing the way Emery wants it. And that consequently, if Ozil has to track back down the channel, he's never going to do it anyway. And if he's got someone behind him he doesn't trust, the bloke in front of him doesn't trust Ozil himself, then it's never going to work, basically. But I just think Emery doesn't trust him long term, and if Emery could click his fingers and Ozil would be gone, he would. But having said that, Chris Wheatley, who's the Arsenal correspondent for Goal, he knows the camp really well, and he did an exclusive the other day. He knows Ozil's agent really well, and basically the exclusive was Ozil's agent said Ozil's not going anywhere.
Yeah,
that's the bottom line.
We can't find anyone else.
Absolutely. So
I think the thing was Ozil, I'll stick up for him on this point because I do feel any time he's not playing, we lack so much creativity.
Yeah, yeah.
We haven't got anyone that would, even if Ramsey's there, Ramsey's not that creative player either. And there's been a number of games this season where you just go, you just need someone to find that final ball. Lacazette, Aubameyang, they're making the runs, but Nairobi's making the runs, and no one's finding them.
Yeah.
And Ozil had that ball. Was that the Fulham game?
Yeah, he played it
sort of around the corner.
Yeah.
They took out five defenders, threaded it through. He's the only player we've got in the squad that can do that.
Yeah.
And we really miss him when he's not there.
Yeah.
But we've got to find a way to be able to fit him into the team that we're solid enough that we don't need him to chase back and make goal line saving clearance, because I do think he does track back, but he doesn't make tackles, he doesn't compete, he just covers the space,
so
and that's not enough
essentially. As long as we can play Huddersfield at home towards the end of the season when they're already relegated and they get a man sent off in the first 10 minutes, he's going to be a will be. I agree.
I can't knock it. You're dead right.
He has got a World Cup winner's medal, to be fair.
He has, but he was playing in a team.
Really average players got it.
Quick name check, because we sort of covered this. What are the panel's thoughts on possible defenders coming in this January? That was Kieran on Twitter asked that. Just quickly, is a yes or no? On loan, Gary Cahill.
Yes, I would.
David?
If there's nobody else.
Mike?
Wasn't a yes or no, yes.
Typical lawyer.
That was a legal maybe.
I read somewhere that Pepe was also considered.
Oh, he's signed for Porto.
He's gone back to Porto,
isn't
he? Yeah, but they were looking at him, apparently.
Thank God for that.
He would certainly add it.
Who did Socrates set up? Just like a couple of, nightclub doormen.
We only play four games between now and the end of the season.
If we could get those two and Rob Van Bommel out of retirement, we'd just be hard bastard FC. Terry Hurlock on the bench.
It would have been entertaining. I'm not sure for who, but it would have been. So there we are. That's Kieran. Let's go back a little. Peter Squire has tweeted: Are the panel convinced that Bernard Leno is the long-term answer in goal? There have been a few calls for Petr Cech to actually start.
As a retired member, all-time member of the Goalkeepers Union and former goalkeeper for the University of Wales Aberystwyth Second 11, 1990-2002. I'd stick with Leno. I really like him, personally. He's still 24, still incredibly raw. I wrote the talking point of the game after Southampton when he committed that incredible sin of missing it by half of 1 millimetre, even though the centre forward was unmarked at the back post because Koscielny's back was still knackered. Sorry, legs were knackered, whatever. Patience is a virtue, especially with goalkeepers. The positives certainly outweigh the negatives so far. His distribution is first class under the way that our head coach wants to play it, so persevere with him for sure.
Yeah, I think if Cech came back, there'd be a massively retrograde step unless Leno is injured, basically. Completely agree with Dave. He has got a lot to improve on, but at the same time, he fits Emery's
tactics perfectly in terms of the fact he is a sweeper keeper and he's brilliant with his feet and he does push the defence in terms of playing out early. He hasn't completely convinced as a goalkeeper in terms of maybe his positioning and even his sort of aerial ability, but that will come. Like you say, he's only 24. 24 is a baby in goalkeeping terms. So yeah, it was interesting the other day that Emery was asked about Kaelin Navas, and sometimes like I was saying about the code and you sort of reading between the lines, when Emery was asked about Suarez, he basically just said, oh, I don't know, which means Emery code for we're working at the moment but we haven't signed him yet. With Kaelin Navas, he just goes no. So I don't think they're looking for another keeper. I know there's been some 18-year-old keeper touted or something, but he's not going to play in the first team, so who cares anyway at the moment, purely in terms of first team sort of matters. So yeah, Leno's there for the rest of the season and then we'll see how he's done for the next 6 months. But yeah, he's a work in progress, but he's certainly good enough to be Arsenal's number one, definitely. Said for a long time,
I think, as well, you know, it comes back to the point I made earlier, he probably suffers from playing behind him.
I played in goal as well, like goalkeeping union with Dave, and there's nothing worse than rubbish centre-halves.
I think, is he more trying to organise the team, or has he maybe not got the confidence to do that?
I think he has got the confidence. I've interviewed him as well.
So maybe that's where it will come.
I interviewed him in the mix zone, and he was surprisingly fragile in terms of his confidence.
How is his English?
He's not completely convinced.
Really good, yeah.
He's not completely convinced yet. And I think you said he's really good with his feet.
Yeah.
Really? I'm not convinced by that. He's more comfortable than he was.
His technical ability is really good, and he played more passes with his feet than anyone else apart from Neuer in the second last season in the Bundesliga.
That's why we've got him.
His technical ability is there, basically. But yeah, maybe his passes haven't been. I don't know what percent it's on. I don't really look in those stats, but yeah, they've been slightly off in terms of the calibration. But at the same time, he's got all the ingredients to be able to do that, I think. But
I still feel nervous when the ball goes near Cech's feet.
I feel nervous when he goes towards any of our players. Inside the penalty box.
He's 37, 38 years old, out of contract in 5.5 months' time. If he wants to stay on, he's going to have a 50% pay cut on a 1-year contract. At the end of that, 50% deduction again. He's going to end up at Fulham or somewhere next season, bless him. So can't put him in goal now.
No.
Okay. Panellist Simon Rose has tweeted to complete the transfer window stuff. Given Welbeck's injury and that we can't overburden Aubameyang and Lacazette by starting them both too often, can Arsenal sustain their challenge this season without signing a third striker during this transfer window? In fairness, it seems to me that generally Lacazette is only ever going to play half a game, and unless it's the cup, in which case Aubameyang is rested. So I think he's already rotating those two. They rarely start together. But do you think we need? I mean, is Eddie Nketiah going to be good enough if one of them gets injured?
I'm sure we've all seen him in the under-18s upwards, and the Norwich game last season when he scored those two goals on his debut. He looked short of confidence on Saturday. I don't know what you thought in terms of missing those early chances. He could have had a hat-trick before half-time. Mm. I think he needs a loan. I think he needs a six-month loan. Mm. Whether he's going to be given that, I don't know. But I think he needs to just go away, move away from Arsenal for 6 months, learn his trade at a lower league club, maybe a championship, maybe League One or something, and come back refreshed, start the season again next year and take it from there. I'm really, really excited about him. He's a really instinctive finisher, but they thrive on confidence, and he looked low on confidence on Saturday. So,
but that's not going to happen unless we do sign someone, surely.
Yeah, he's not going to go anywhere, basically.
Because we get someone in on loan. Yeah. I mean, if we get someone in on loan and then release him on loan. Yeah, because my feeling is we probably do need a strike, because otherwise we're running the risk of one of them getting injured, and then we are down to the bare bones.
Yeah.
Even though it might cost us a few hundred thousand euros of our own money, my understanding is there is a top of the range young Japanese striker at VfB Stuttgart at the moment who we can recall from loan. Okay, I can't remember his name. We have got that young Japanese centre forward.
Asano, is it?
Is it Asano?
Takayama Asano or something?
Asano.
Yeah.
So has he been doing this season?
He's had Inamoto levels of performance.
I was going to say, he's 45 year old Inamoto.
He scored once in 9 games, I think.
Oh, okay.
He's only made 9 appearances, but he's scored a goal. I can't remember. I read that yesterday, but he's a senior professional member of staff who's on our payroll, yes. So he's there to be recalled. Actually, where's Joo Park Young?
Do you know what? I was just trying to remember his name. Well, he's David Goose Shrewsbury. Yeah, what signing he was. 4.5 million of anyone's money.
Him and Carver Diawara. Seriously.
There's been a few.
And Jeremy Aliadier is only 34 years old, and he's seen around the club an awful lot.
Yeah, he looks after his body.
He never got the testimonial, which is his years of service in theory justified.
He's an invincible as well, which is
didn't make too many goals.
He was in the squad, loosely. Right, I'll just do some brief cronky stuff, just to name check, because I like to acknowledge that we get contributions. So on Twitter, I'll start with Brian Dawes, our regular contributor to the print version of the Gooner. Is there any way fans can acquire a decent owner other than buying the club themselves? Right, okay. I think we don't really need to discuss that, Brian, but we take your point.
Well, Uncle Alicia offered him £1 billion for Arsenal, didn't he,
Yes, well, that's a fair
probably
point.
Probably undervaluing it.
The other one related to this is from Neg. Oh, that's his Twitter handle, or hashtag Neg. It's, to avoid living the rest of my life in a state of permanent frustration, how should I adjust my expectations nowadays, given the club is run, given the way the club is run relative to our rivals?
I like the way he's phrased.
Hashtag Neg.
Let's get it going. Let's get it trending.
Neg.
That sounds like John Cleese in Clockwise. Disappointments. I mean, everyone's disappointments. It's a day by day thing, but it's the hope that kills you.
The bottom line is we've been basically, effectively, it seems, superseded by Liverpool and Tottenham, teams with, historically, a lower revenue than ours. And we're now trying to catch up. And it's different, isn't it? We haven't been in this situation of lagging behind since probably just before George Graham came.
John Haldos,
So, you know, it's certainly...
Well, I think at that point, it was England's own game. I mean, it was just when the European ban was coming into play as well, post-Heysel and everything. Whereas now, I mean, we are the second biggest sporting accolade in the world after the NFL in terms of global viewers. Yeah. And we are ultimately a bigger brand and franchise than any other London brand and franchise. Liverpool, probably bigger in the UK, sure, but worldwide, Arsenal are bigger because we're London. And London is a biggest tourist location than Liverpool. Yeah. I don't know about you, but when I leave in 90 minutes, the amount of people who rush down the front to have their cheesy selfie are holidayers. I mean, I'm a baseball fan, and I go on US vacations every other year, and I go to like 4 or 5 baseball games, and that's the way we're going now.
Do you wear a baseball cap?
Absolutely. Well, sadly,
do you wear it backwards?
Hell no. Not 87. My team, the Red Sox, are owned by Liverpool, which I hate. But I mean, ultimately, we're in London. We are a bigger brand than everyone apart from maybe Chelsea, but thankfully, we can squeeze 60,000 in, or 59,800 rather than Chelsea until they move to their new stadium. So even though we're behind football wise, money wise, and branding wise, no, we're all right.
Yeah. And then bear in mind, 50 million, if we qualify for the Champions League next year, will be automatically in our coffers, as it were. So, there's a lot more money to come.
There's a big if there.
Well, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. Certainly looking at the league table.
Should we prioritise? Given Emery's record, should the club prioritise the Europa League?
Not yet. But I think if you come into sort of April and, Arsenal sort of mired in fifth, 10 points away from fourth place, then, yeah, play your strongest side in hopefully the quarterfinal, semi-final, whatever, and take it from there, because you've obviously got a route through to the Champions League. And Emery's, of course, and distance winner in terms of Europa League as well. And I think he wants to win it. It wasn't Wenger sort of just going, oh, yeah, we're in the quarterfinals now.
Didn't he win it like 3 years in a row?
Yeah, absolutely.
There was none of the early group stage games where you felt he put out a really weakened team. Yeah. Apart from maybe the last one.
I did all the home games and I did Sporting Lisbon away, and it was comfortable.
He does seem to play every game to win, you know.
Yeah.
And it just feels a bit different to Wenger's philosophy, which was, I put out a team that should have been good enough.
Yeah.
to I'm putting out a team to win.
Yeah, absolutely. You know? Yeah, completely different.
I just kind of feels different. At the moment, I wouldn't change that philosophy. I think he's got the balance right at the moment.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, that was during our 22 game unbeaten run. So yeah. You know, and it's still can't criticise him. For
absolutely,
it.
Yeah. Still, there was a lot more to give.
Next
well.
Round should be.
Yeah, so who else is doing Belarus? Oh, do you know? I looked at the coach to Belarus just because I was having a chat with people today. 4 days. It'll be at least £85, but. Even so, I'm not sure.
I was praying for Vienna because I've got a work trip in Vienna right. that week, and it was Monday to Wednesday, and I was like, this could work out really well. This could work out really.
I can't believe it's on Valentine's Day as well. I can, but it's just ridiculous. But yeah, I think I'm gonna have 3 or 4 days in Minsk. So if anyone fancies joining.
Amazon, the clubs.
Make sure you speak to Tim Payton before you go because he went last time
right.
and he got in a lot of bother because the visa.
Because he was Tim Payton.
He left
from a different port than he arrived.
Did he? I've got to get a working visa.
The visa does
so.
Not allow.
Yeah, yeah.
He was held for a couple of hours, I think.
Yeah.
Oh, well, she said a couple of days then. No, I don't see. Stop, man.
Let's talk about. Unai Emery's press conference style. Now, first of all, I'll ask you, Leif, because obviously you're in there. It doesn't always answer the question. Now, is that his poor English, or is he being clever in playing dumb?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, where do you start? I mean, I was sort of in his introductory press conference in the Diamond Club, or introductory meet the journalist, basically, and it was quite an honour to be there, and then sort of met him and had a chat, and his English that day, I mean, not that I'm knocking anyone for speaking another language, but it wasn't very good.
Mm.
And he obviously did a lot of intensive lessons over the summer, came back and there was a few more words added to his vocabulary and it sort of made a bit more sense. But I used to take down shorthand. I always took down shorthand with Wenger, obviously had my dictaphone as well, just as a backup. But I can't do it with Emery because there's so many clauses and he just goes off on a tangent and it doesn't actually make sense. And then you're trying to do it. All I do post-match reaction now, I just do a transcription, basically. I don't do a featurey style. I don't do a report. I don't do, in terms of the post-match reaction report, I don't do anything. I just do literally a transcription because you have to polish the quotes because it just doesn't make sense, basically. And Wenger would always give you really good copy. Whatever you thought about Wenger, he would always answer a question.
He was
completely disingenuous at times and he would never answer the question, but he would always give you a headline. He'd always give you
does Unai Emery give you a good headline?
Never. And it's really interesting what you were saying a minute ago, because I'd love to be able to speak Spanish or you know, understand his French in a way, because when he was at PSG, because I want to know if he is actually very articulate or is he really sort of just plays a dead bat on anything football related in any language, basically. I'd love to see how he answers questions in Spanish, whether it's really lyrical, whether it's really interesting, whether he actually answers the question, because he doesn't do that half the time in his sort of halted English, God bless him. So it is really interesting. But from a journalist's point of view, being sat 5 to 10 yards away from him, it's really frustrating because you don't know what he's saying half the time. When you do live tweeting when there's no embargo, like after post-match press conferences at Arsenal, You have to polish the quote because it just doesn't make sense, basically. And it's just really, really frustrating when Wenger would just give you straight copy. So.
I think that's interesting because, like, you know, there's quite a lot of times I read the report in the paper and you'll read the quote and you go, what does that mean?
Yeah, you know, and that's after it's been polished off.
And why have they printed that? Because it makes no there's no context to it. And it's just like.
But the thing is, it's all about the quotes.
Just doing it verbatim.
It's all about the quotes because you need the quote to leave in the story, and obviously, you've got source and stuff.
But when it's like that, do you really?
I know. There's been times when I've pulled the quote because it just doesn't make sense, and I've just sort of.
I understand, you know, that as a journalist, you think you need the quote, but actually, when it makes no sense.
Absolutely. But if you're doing a post-match reaction on these press conferences, you have to do the bloke talking. But you're absolutely right. It's really difficult. So hopefully we'll just, and what's really good is he's got a really good interpreter. He's a young lad. We follow each other on Twitter. And he's really, really good, really professional. And what Emery does sometimes is if someone asks a question and he needs to buy a bit of time, it will sort of go to him and say, what did he say? And then repeat in Spanish. And he knows exactly what the question is, but it gives him 3 or 4 seconds just to give a little bit more in terms of probably answering in English, really. What I'd like him to do is actually answer it in Spanish and get translated by someone who can really speak English and Spanish well and translate it back in English, because I'm sure it'd be more articulate. It certainly would be more interesting anyway, but it is what it is at the moment. So.
Is Mark Gunella still accompanying him at the press conferences?
Yes, yeah, yeah. Good old Mark.
I'm sure he'd love the idea of giving you absolutely nothing.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah, yeah, yeah. Don't get me started, Mark. God bless you.
So we're going to end with Man United in the FA Cup. Ooh. Yes, indeed. We have been drawn to face our old rivals in the fourth round. First question, full strength team, do you think? Or should we do the old rotation, the cup rotation?
Full strength, absolutely, full strength.
Do you think you will?
What are the fixtures week before, week after?
Chelsea on the 19th and then Man City away on Sunday.
No, oh, no, we've got midweek.
Cardiff, Wednesday, you're right, yeah.
Tuesday.
Is it? I think it's on Tuesday.
So that means it had to be Saturday.
Have they actually decided?
I thought it had been confirmed. It's Saturday lunchtime.
Oh, I saw a tweet on that. I didn't actually double check that because I was just leaving.
It's not good for viewing figures.
No, oh, but it is in Asia.
It's going to be Friday.
Yeah,
Friday night would have been Asia. Great.
Christ, yeah. Yeah.
Friday night 12, would have been an atmosphere.
9,000 Man United fans down on a Friday night.
12:30 lunchtime Asian market.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
What's that BT then?
I believe it would be a BT. For sure, yeah.
Is that right about the time of the Chinese New Year as well?
It will be. Yeah.
You'll hear far choice.
That's a good point.
Do not know. Well, anyway, let's go back a bit. And I'm going to ask each one of you for a memory of a past FA Cup clash with United. And I know which one you're going for. And I will let you go first in case anyone else claims
cheers,
it.
Cheers,
so, I'll do that because I've got my three lined up.
I'm doing it more just to get the plug in about the Gazette. But basically, yeah, obviously we had a bit of a chat this morning. I wrote a piece for the Gooner about 5-6 years ago. Kevin Witch's organisational skills are absolutely amazing. WhatsApp Kev said, have you got that piece that I did about 11 memorable victories over Man United? Literally 2.4 milliseconds later, it was in my inbox. You know, and it was, I put it out today in the Gazette. It's a bit of unashamed nostalgia. To answer your question, 20th of February 1988, the Brian McLaren, in case anyone doesn't know, Brian McLaren balloons the ball into the North Bank. I was in the North Bank. I was a Brooklyn boy, but I was in North Bank that day. And honestly, it was one of the most amazing episodes. That season, there were 50,000 plus
yes.
crowds. I know you say it now to kids about, oh, well, we get 51,000, yeah. Great, allegedly.
Yeah.
No, they were proper. You know, the Everton game in the semi final of the League Cup, I ran to the top of the block behind the clock end because they'd locked the North Bank. Got all the way to the top. The coppers at the top, they heard us running up. They said, you get down there or we'll nick you. We had to run all the way down. Somehow we got into the clock end that night. It was one of those nights when the noise rolls around. You've got all the dark, you know, the floodlights, everything. That was brilliant. But that Man United game was obviously on a Saturday afternoon. It was amazing. Kids need to look it on. Look it up on YouTube, kids, basically, because it was absolutely fantastic. People talk about the feud starting that day. Obviously, you could talk about January 87, Rocky got sent off at Old Trafford. I date it back, and this was my first Arsenal Man United game as a real youngster. May 1983, Remy Moses got sent off. 2nd of May 1983, Arsenal beat Man United 3-0 after having lost to United in the FA Cup semi-final and two games in the Milk Cup semi-final. And I think Arsenal had enough that day. Remy Moses got sent off late on. Arsenal bossed the show, but it didn't mean anything. There was 16,000 hybrid. I think the feud started from that day. But obviously 87, and then you had the 88 game, which was the real sort of touch paper in terms of McClare and then Winterburn. And I interviewed Winterburn via Player of Legend earlier in the season. I asked him about it. I said, you talked to Brian McClare? And he literally flinched. He obviously gave a really dead batted. I don't see him around that much, but I respect him, blah, blah. But you could see he fucking hated him. He absolutely hated him. So I was quite pleased to see him that, basically. But yeah, that game, look it up on YouTube, kids. It's absolutely amazing.
Okay. David, go on.
2005 FA Cup final, daylight robbery. I remember the year before, the Invincibles year, when we lost those two games in a week. Chelsea in the Champions League semi-final were at home, Wayne Bloody Bridge, scoring in front of the clock end. And then we lost 1-0 in the semi-final at Villa Park to Paul Scholes. And then I remember... we didn't have a centre forward in the final, did we? We had to play Dennis up front on his own because there's no Thierry Henry or anything. And Dennis has never been a number nine, he's a classic number 10. Didn't have a nine to pass it to. And I think we hit the bar in the first 5 minutes and we started really well. And then after that, Man United beat us like a ginger stepson. And you know, if it was a boxing match, the referee would have like thrown the towel in after about an hour. But we managed to hold on for a 0-0. Jose Antonio Reyes became the second man to get sent off in an FA Cup final for throwing a bottle at Gary Neville after the game or something.
Well, somebody had done that before and got sent off.
So, yeah,
don't blame him, to be fair.
And then, the winner, the guy scored the winner in the semi-final the year before, Paul Scholes, has a penalty saved by Zimad German, Maddy Enns, and then the skipper, Paddy V.
Yeah.
In what turned out to be his last game for the club,
last kick,
yes. scored the penalty. We won the FA Cup in Cardiff, and like I said, daylight robbery.
Yeah, I stayed in Cardiff that night. It was glorious.
Well, that was the one where we all talked to them about having US.
Yeah, games,
Okay. Well, since you pair have gone first and Nick two of my memories, I've got to have two. But one, I'll finish on a positive. But probably the most vivid memory is the loss, the Villa Park one,
the 99.
Yeah,
it was one of
those games.
Yeah,
I mean they were two titanic clashes. Mm. I mean that was the last FA Cup semi final, wasn't it? Replay.
Yeah,
it was the last time there was.
Yeah.
Obviously, everyone remembers the goal because the BBC can't help but remind us every single time.
It's all about the chest.
Bergkamp in the last minute, 92nd minute, Parlour tripped, clear cut penalty to win the tie, to ruin the treble, to win the double.
Yeah,
that's what it would have been. I believe to this day that we would have won the league that year and the FA Cup.
They would have lost momentum. That goal would have gone in, wouldn't it? Would have posted Leeds.
Yeah. So that was the bad memory. And I remember we got in the car and literally we did not speak until we reached the M25.
Yeah, absolutely.
We just drove. It was just like heartbreaking.
Yeah, yeah.
But let's end on a positive one. 79.
Did you go?
I wasn't there, but
I was a bit too
come young. On, we all remember it. I mean, I was 10, and therefore still young, and prone to getting upset if Arsenal lost. So when they equalised, I was on the verge of tears, and I'm not even sure I saw the winning goal because there were tears in my eyes. And there were tears in my eyes. So that was a glorious moment, glorious memory. And Liam Brady talking about it the other week when we did the IASA meeting, and he talked about that and how it was just like, get the ball in their half because we're going to lose otherwise. You know, got the ball in their half, 6-3, and the rest is like, so.
Goosebumps, glorious moment. Yeah, absolutely.
Very good end to a game. All right, and that is the end of the podcast, but we will finish with the usual plug for the Gooner. The current issue, with a free 2019 calendar, is currently on sale and will remain so for the home games against Chelsea, Man United in the Cup, and Cardiff. There will be a new one out for Southampton in February. Also, by the time you are listening to this, we hope to have fully launched the campaign to garner enough subscribers to see us continue beyond the current season. So it's Save the Gooner once more. It's going to be an annual process, but we are looking into possibly offering a standing order or a direct debit option if we can get our heads around the forms required for the latter anyway. Time will tell, but if you do wish to see the Gooner survive, please sign up. At present, details can be found on the rear of the calendar in the current issue or on the subscriptions page of our online gooner.com website store, and I'll plan to post an exclusive on the site itself maybe tomorrow, Wednesday, so that'll be before this is out there. As ever, a reminder that you can contact us regarding anything to do with the podcast via Twitter at GoonerPodcast and email GoonerPodcast@gmail.com. Many thanks for the questions and topics submitted for today. I think I've got everybody in. And with that, it is goodbye. From David.
Thank you and goodbye.
From Mike.
Good night.
And from Laith.
Cheers, Kev.
We will be back with another podcast in February. Until then, this is your host, Kevin Witcher, saying goodbye and thanks for listening.
La-di-da-di-da, la-di-da-di-dee, all good friends and jolly good company. Way!